the passage more closely. But what he appears to be saying here is, you know, when you're doing your cost accounting, you're assuming, first of all, that when you increase the, if you want to increase the amount of the consumer's good you're producing, you have to have a proportional increase in the factors of production. You know, you're not going to get sudden jumps. You can get kind of an established relationship, because otherwise you couldn't do your cost accounts. You know, you're saying this is going to cost so much to produce this quantity of good. If I increase it by half, I'm going to get this much more production of good. And you're also assuming that if you produce a certain amount of a good, then you'll get an increase in the consumer satisfaction. And he says that might not work out, you know, sort of. In other words, what he's saying here is just that numerical calculations don't always accurately represent reality, because you might find it takes more. If you don't get a proportional increase in the amount of the good when you increase the factors of production by a certain amount, and it might be that once you get the good produced, you don't get the increase in consumer satisfaction that you were assuming. So what he's basically doing here is saying there's a calculation, these are two ways calculation could be inexact. I think that appears to be what he's saying there, you see. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. So when he says in the first one, first every increase in the quantity of factors expended for the production of a consumer's good, and then he says increases its power to remove uneasiness, by its he means, does he mean an individual consumer good?
Yeah, the power of the consumer, the power of that increase in the consumer's good. So he says it might turn out it's not that much of a good at all, even if you're calculating that it is. So I say, well, you know, you're adding to this, to produce this consumer's good, but it might not be doing you much good. It's not going to, you know, if it's not going to be able to remove uneasiness, that means the consumers don't want it. So, you know, you made a mistake, like you produce something they don't want. So you calculate it, well, if I spend so much, I'll get this much of the good. So you get that much of the good, but the people don't want it, so it isn't doing you any good. And then the second one is, you think, well, I put this quantity to produce more of the good, but the amount that you get isn't what you thought it would be.
Is the first one related to the diminishing marginal utility at all? Is that what he's talking about?
Well, it's not, yeah, it is related, but it's sort of, you really miscalculated. You thought you may have tried to take count of diminishing marginal utility, but you got it completely wrong, so it turned out it isn't of any use to people at all. People just don't want it.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Oh, good. Now I have to, oh, good, I've got a minute. I have 1 minute to go. I better think of something fast here. And all right. I think we'll get started now. Now today I'm going to be talking about taxation and government spending, two topics that are very much in the news now, at least American news. But before I do that, I want to say a little bit about two points that came up in the last lecture. There were two questions that people asked I thought were extremely good questions. Now, the last time Erica asked me an excellent question, like I just said, and I realized after I'd answered it and once we shut off the video, there was a much better answer that I could have given her. I didn't give at all an adequate answer to the question. question that Eric asked. It was a very good question, but I didn't have a good answer. I mean, that's very typical. I thought afterwards, why didn't I say this particular point? It just didn't occur to me. Now, remember, the question she asked was this. Do you remember in the lecture when we talked about international trade, I was discussing one argument that sometimes people who favor protective tariffs use, they say, well, look, if you have a lot of import, then suppose somebody says, well, this doesn't cause unemployment because the people who buy the product, if people who will get the goods, say the foreigners, will get our American dollars, so then they'll spend them on American industries. If we have increased imports, we'll export more goods to pay for them. So there isn't, people think, well, supposing, say, Japan undersells American car production, say that Toyota knocks out certain comparable cars that's produced in the U.S., so American auto workers lose their jobs, then they say, well, look, this shows the foreign trade is bad for American workers because it's causing these workers to be unemployed. And then the counter to that was, look, the Japanese, when they get American dollars, they're going to be spending them on American products, so employment will go up in these other areas. Remember, we covered that. So then, an objection to that, remember, in economics, especially the way I like to do it, very often, you have an objection, and there's a counter, then there's a further objection to that. So it's proceeding kind of a dialectic way with it. This is the objection, here's the answer, now there's a new objection. That's the way I like to do things. I hope it doesn't confuse anybody. So the objection is, well, why do they have to spend their American dollars on American products? Remember, the answer to that I suggested was, well, what are they going to do with the American dollars if they don't spend them on American products? The Japanese don't use dollars for their currency. They have to be able either to spend them on American products or exchange the dollars for people who would spend them on American products. So the argument I gave was, well, if you've got American dollars, if the Japanese have American dollars, they're going to have to spend them eventually on American products. Now, the question Eric asked, which was an excellent question, was she said, well, supposing we have everybody, say, using a gold standard, an international gold standard, so everybody's using gold as the currency, or Japanese are using gold, Americans, everybody's using gold. So then it appears Scott said the Japanese now have more gold. So isn't the argument then, well, they don't have to spend the gold on American products, because I can't use the argument that, well, if they've got American dollars, they have to spend them eventually on American products because they don't use dollars in Japan domestically. If they've got gold, they do use them domestically. So why can't they just spend them on Japanese products? And if that was the case, maybe free trade would lead to net unemployment in America. You see how the thing works. They don't have to spend it on American products. Now, the answer I gave last week, Eric, especially when you said, well, it seems likely they would find something of use in America, so wouldn't this be kind of unlikely? But I don't think that was an adequate answer. There's a much better answer we could give, that can be given, that actually involves one of the most basic doctrines of international trade. So what we have to realize here is what's going to happen, and I think someone said the statue suggested the Japanese are going to get rich, they've got a lot of gold. Well, that's right, the Japanese have more gold coming in, we're assuming, you know, they sold a lot of cars, so they're getting gold coming in. Now, what happens when they get gold, you know, they can say they spend it on Japanese products, you have an increase in the supply of money, increase in gold. So what's going to happen is that prices in Japan will tend to rise because you've got more money. And so like any other commodity, you increase the supply of it, the supply of gold is going to drive up the price of everything else. You're lowering the price of money. You're increasing the prices for everything else. It's adding to the money supply, so prices are going up. Now, if that happens, other things being equal, Japanese goods will be going up in price compared to American goods. So if this process continues, then American goods will be relatively cheaper than Japanese goods, and the Japanese will eventually buy the American goods because the prices have become relatively cheap. See, prices of Japanese goods have gone up because of the increased gold supply, so American prices haven't gone up since gold is coming out, and then their American prices will become relatively more attractive. So that's why, even if you have an international currency, as I say, this is an excellent question that Eric asked, if you have an international currency, you still don't have net unemployment in America. So now I see Patricia said something about buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Yeah, that's a separate point, but here I'm just dealing with what happens if they don't do that. I covered the investment bit in the last lecture. Okay, so you see, even if we're not talking about national currency, this point about we don't have net unemployment from free trade still holds because of the effect of gold. If you're using gold, if you get an increase in gold in one country will drive up prices in that country and make goods in other countries more attractive, so trade will flow to those countries. So, we covered this now. So, one point that historical interest, one of the greatest British philosopher, David Hume, in the 18th century, is also an outstanding contributor in economics, wrote about this mechanism where you have adjustments in the supply of money will affect prices, and this has an effect on international trade. So Erica's question suggested one of the most important theories in international trade. I'm sorry, I didn't think of it at the time she asked. I thought of it right afterwards. I should have mentioned it in the previous lecture. Okay, now the second question is also an excellent question. This one was asked by Jay last time. Now, in my lecture last time, I had made some comments when I talked about free trade. I said various things, tariffs are bad, they interfere with trade. I criticized tariffs, I was very much against them. And what Jay wanted to know was what's the relation between the economic points I made in the lecture and the evaluation of ethical states I made about it. For example, when I said tariffs are a bad idea, is this part of economics? I'm going to address the relationship between ethics and economics in the lecture the next time, but I wanted to say a little bit about that because it's an extremely important question. I'm grateful to Jay for raising it. So when I say tariffs are a bad idea, I'm not assuming that this is part of economics. All that you can say in economics is that tariffs will have certain effects that will restrict trade, that will interfere with the International Division of Labor. So I'm assuming that we accept certain ethical claims, such as those we say increasing the International Division of Labor will add to prosperity. We think prosperity is a good thing, so then we say that something that restricts the International Division of Labor is, to that extent, bad. So if we accept that, then we can say, well, this isn't the point against tariffs. But you don't have to accept that. All you have to get in economics is it has this effect that tariffs will restrict the International Division of Labor. Conceivably, somebody said, well, I just think we should have a kind of a more nationalistic economy. I don't like the International Division of Labor. I think we should be more self-sufficient. If a nation could accept that, it would have certain consequences in reducing the standard of living, but people might want to say that's fine with them. So all the economists are doing is pointing out the consequences of various choices. So when I was saying that certain things are good or bad, I was doing it from a certain ethical point of view. I thought certain values, such as prosperity, would be one that would be very commonly accepted, especially in a libertarian audience. Most of the people here are sympathetic to libertarian, but you don't have to accept that. So it is very clear, and I'm grateful to Jay for emphasizing, for asking this question, that the ethical judgments you make are distinct from the economic analysis. And just one thing, I don't want to get into next week's lecture now, but one thing, it doesn't follow from that that say the ethical judgments are distinct from the economic analysis, but the ethical judgments are just subjective, they don't have any real basis, they're just people's opinion. That's a separate view of ethics that may or may not be true. Even if it's false, even if there's a completely objective, true ethics, it isn't a matter of subjective opinion, it's still separate from economics. This is the basic point. So now, I want to go into what we're doing today, and I'm going to deal first with taxation. Now, Albert Wendell Holmes was the famous Supreme Court justice. For a long time, he was the Supreme Court Justice, I think, until he was in 90 years old, he was a very famous judge. He once said, taxation is the price we pay for civilization. I must tell you, that is not the point of view from which I'm going to be talking about taxation. But you should be aware that some people actually like taxation. But you can see if we look at taxation economically, the taxation of wealth and income, wealth is so taxation is the price of civilization. That was one of the Wendell Holmes things. So, well, you know, we need to have a government in order to have civilization, so we need to have taxation to pay for it. That was his point of view, definitely not mine. That interest or the humor to get us going. Taxation of wealth would be taxation of your total assets or any assets you have, and income is what you have coming in. So when you have taxation of wealth and income, it reduces the incentive that people have to work and invest, and thus reduces production. And this is called economically called the substitution effect, because people are substituting leisure for work. So the idea is, supposing, say, let's imagine you're earning $40,000 a year, and the government said, let's assume it doesn't have any taxes, but there's no income, and the government says, well, now you have to pay 25% of this $30,000 in taxes, so that's going to, according to the substitution effect, you're going to be less likely to work. You won't want to work because you're not going to be getting as much. So, in effect, if the government's going to be taking away some of your money, in effect, this means you're getting less money to work. So, it would be as if, say, the employer offered you less money, and you're not going to be as likely to accept the job offer. So remember, what you get, your salary, consists of all the benefits you get minus all the costs. So suppose you have a $40,000 salary, and the government taking away 25% of that. In effect, you're only getting a $30,000 salary, not a $40,000 salary. So you're going to be less likely to want to work. You maybe prefer doing other things. One of the basic assumptions of economics, sometimes people like certain kinds of jobs, they enjoy a job, but basically, in order to get people to work, you have to offer them something to do that. People aren't going to work for you for free. If you want to get people's work, you have to offer them money. So to the extent you're getting less money, you're going to get less work. The same principle also applies to wealth, say people have. Imagine you have a big tax on your savings account, so then you're going to not want to put in as much into your savings account because the government's going to be taking things away from you, so you're naturally not going to want to invest that much in it. In say your savings or the stock market, your money invested, the government's going to take away what you part of what you earn. You're going to invest. Now, Rebecca says low interest rates is the same. Yes, I mean, it's exactly the same principle. If you have a higher interest rate, you're going to be more likely to want to save because you'll be getting more money. It's the same principle. You're considering what you get for engaging in the activity, whether it's saving or working. So you want to see, what do I get? What's going to be taken away from me? So this is actually going to influence your decisions for you. Now, one thing to remember is, if you're trying to estimate the incentive effect of tax law, say how much is the incentive effect, how much your tax is going to interfere with your incentive to work. So what you're concerned with is the marginal rate. This means, what is the rate on income or wealth you expect to get. So supposing, say, I'm considering a job offering, somebody's offering me $30,000, plus they've never offered me that much money to work, but I'm supposing somebody offered me $30,000. So what I'd be concerned with is, what is the rate that I'm going to have to pay on this increase in what I'm getting. I'm going to say, if I put out a certain amount of more effort, more work, how much am I going to be charged by the government? So that the marginal rate is how much on any increase that I want to put out, what am I going to be charged? Remember, I mean, Mises emphasizes very much in action, that action is looking toward the future. I'm not what's happened in the past can't be changed. That's what I'm trying to do, is say, how can I achieve my most highly valued preference now? So I'm going to be concerned with what are the costs that are going to affect my activities now. Now, so you get the argument so far, we said, well, if there's a tax, it's going to affect incentives to work or to save negatively because people won't want to give what they make to the government. Say if I said to, suppose somebody passed the law, because they wouldn't pass such a law, if somebody said, you have to give me half of anything you get, any income you get, you're probably not going to be as anxious to work as if there weren't such a law, because you have to give me half of what you get, so you're not going to do that. Now, there's some people, though, who object to this incentives argument. It seems like a pretty straightforward argument thing. Well, if you're not going to get to keep everything you earn, you're not going to want to work as hard. So now, these people object, don't deny this effect altogether. They say, yes, this does operate, this effect operates. So they say, remember, this is called the substitution effect. You're going to substitute leisure for work if taxes go up. So they say this has to be considered together with another effect, which is called the income effect. And this, to some extent, goes the other way. So remember, the substitution effect is saying if you, the government is increasing taxes, then you're going to be less likely to work. So there's some people say, well, look, there's this other effect that goes the other way. These paradoxical say, if the government increases taxes, then you will increase the amount of work you're doing. You won't decrease it. That seems like a strange thing to say, but it isn't so strange, actually. So, let's say, how would these economists argue that people don't respond to taxes by substituting leisure for work? Seems like kind of an odd argument at first, because he's saying, look, your salary in effect going down because the government's taking something away from you, but you're going to work harder. That sounds kind of odd. But we could come up with cases where this effect actually works. I'm supposing it's very important to someone that he earns $100,000 per year. So if taxes go up, he may work more so he can still earn the money he wants. Okay? Government has raised taxes 10%, so the person will have to work harder to get his $100,000, because if he doesn't, then he'll be getting less money. So to make this a little intuitively plausible, we can imagine a case like this. Suppose someone is married and then the marriage doesn't work out and gets divorced. So now the person is going to have to pay his wife or the husband, going to have to pay alimony, going to have to give part of the money to his partner. He won't be able to give it, won't be able to keep it, all the money within the same family. He's going to have to give it now to someone else who's no longer part of his family. So it may be that the person would say, well, since I'm going to have to give my wife alimony, I'm not going to want to work so hard. But he may have the other view. He may say, well, I want to keep up my standard of living, so I'm going to have to work extra hard so I can keep up my standard of living and still pay my wife alimony. So see, this is the income effect. And see, if this operates, it to some extent counters the substitution effect. The substitution effect is, well, look, if my income taxes go up, it's going to decrease my incentive to work. But the income effect is, well, maybe not, because what if I want to preserve my standard of living, so then I won't then I'll still just work harder so I can get the money I was getting before as much of it as I can. Now, whether the substitution effect or the income effect applies in a given case is an empirical question, kind of fancy way of saying we can't figure it out just by thinking about it, we just have to see what happens. But as you can suspect, they'll just trying to reason things out common sense, the substitution effect tends to work out much more important, be much more important than the income effect. Most people will respond by reducing their work if taxes go up. Now, one point that Murray Rothbard made is, I think, a very good one, a very insightful one that he made, characteristically insightful. I see that there is a question on, let me just go back, someone had a question on line 7. The question was, if someone can't raise his price to cover the loss by taxing, imagine there's, I guess, a tax on business. Well, you can't always do that, because if you did that, you might not find that customers would buy as much on the higher price. So I'm not covering this, of course, what's called incidents of taxation, but generally, a businessman can't pass on his tax increases to the consumers, because if he could do that, well, then he would have raised and still gotten as much money, would have raised the price before. So generally, you can't do that. But I think generally, you find the substitution effect is more potent than the income effect. People do respond by not working as much if taxes go up. But suppose, one thing Rothbard pointed out, that suppose the income effect does operate, let's say people work more because they want to keep their standard of living, so that the increase in taxes doesn't decrease the amount of work, then there's still problems with taxation, because people, if that happens, what happened is people have to give up leisure. You have to work harder to maintain your standard of living, so you're having to shift your preference for leisure in a way that you would have preferred to avoid. You say you wanted to work 8 hours per day, but now you find you have to work, say, 10 hours per day to keep the same income because of tax increase. So then you've had to shift away from your preference for leisure. You would have rather just worked 8 hours instead of 10 hours. So this is a negative effect. So we shouldn't think, well, if it turns out the income effect operates, then really taxation doesn't do any harm. It's still interfering with the way people would have preferred to balance labor and leisure. Now, there's some economists, and one I'm going to be mentioning in this talk is like Robert Frank. He's a very good, influential economist. I think he's good, but he's very much an interventionist. He's on my mind because I've just been reviewed a number of his books. He says something like this: well, don't we know it's very good if people in economies save and invest. If you save and you're building up capital stock, and people eventually have higher standards of living. So saving is a very good thing. So if you have a lot of savings, this will promote economic growth. So you have as much savings as possible. So why not have no taxes on savings at all? That sounds pretty good. It's a good idea. And then he said, well, why not have a tax just on consumption, say a sales tax just on consumption? And he said, in his view, a lot of consumption expense is wasteful. changing something like this, what we're going to do volume of the year, we said something like this. Well, people build, say you build a very big house. Why do you build a very big house? Well, because you want to have a bigger house than your neighbors do. So then your neighbor will build a house to try to match you, and they'll build a still bigger house. So if what you want to do is just to pass your neighbor, then if you tax away a lot of the money people are spending on consumption, people will have less money to spend on arms races where one person is trying to outspend the other. So you're spending only because the other person is spending. So if you didn't do that, everybody would be better off. And I think it's clear, because I'm not really going to go into this particular analysis, but it's clear he's just trying to substitute his view of what proper consumption expenditures to what people in the economy said. Well, I, Robert Frank, don't like the way people are spending money there. My view is it's wasteful, so people shouldn't be doing that if people are not saving enough. But again, now here, getting back to the question Jay asked last time, it's very important to make sure we know what the ethical assumption we're making is. What Rothbard asked is, why should the government try to alter people's preference for consumption against savings? Why should we say the more savings, the better? You say, well, if that's going to promote economic growth, that's a push back question. Why should we say the more economic growth, the better? So what the ethical assumption Rothbard is operating from, again, this is not part of economics, just a particular view of the world, but it's a possible one, is that people, we should not try to interfere with people's own preferences. It's up to individuals how they want to allocate their money between consumption spending and savings. And savings, we shouldn't try to use the government to interfere with that, so to speak. This is, I think, it's a good criticism Rothbard makes of this plan, just the consumption tax. The part about not having a savings tax is a very good one, but the part that's different is why the consumption tax. But Rothbard says, yes, let's not have a savings tax, but let's not substitute a high consumption tax instead. Now, as I mentioned before, it turns out that the substitution effect, let's say if 10 people have to substitute leisure for labor taxes, a lot of people won't want to work very hard, they won't want to work as hard as they did before if their taxes go up because they don't want to have to pay to the government, they don't want to give away what they're in. This usually prevails over the income effect. Remember, the income effect says people will work hard because they want to keep their standard of living. If they're earning, say, $50,000 in taxes, they're going to work harder so they can still earn $50,000. So it turns out that the substitution effect usually prevails. And again, this is an empirical question, it's just something we have to find out. We can't decide this just by a priori reason, it's just like a sit down and think about which is more. A lot of economics is a priori reason, but this we just have to find out which is the case. Now, Arthur Laffer, who was an influential economist during the Reagan administration in the 1980s, and other economists are called supply-side economists, like Judy Wolinsky was one, Paul Craig Roberts, remember others. They made this argument. They said because of the substitution effect, people are going to respond to incentives if taxes are up, they're going to work less hard. The government can sometimes get more revenue with lower marginal tax rates than with higher 1. So you think that if tax rates go up, well, wouldn't you think the government's going to get more money? You think, well, say you have to pay, say, 90% on incomes over $1 million, then the government's going to be taking in more money, say, if you only have to pay 20% on incomes over $1 million. You know, you're going to get a much larger chunk of the person's income, so then the government wouldn't be making more. But Laffer said, you know, this isn't necessarily true because of the substitution effect, because even though the government is getting a higher percentage of what people earn, people aren't going to be willing to work as much on the higher rate, so it could turn out they actually get less. So if the tax rate get really high, people won't want to produce, and so not much revenue will be taken in. You see how this, I'm telling you, it works. It's pretty straightforward. So what Laffer said, and I'm not actually drawing the curve because I'm horrible at drawing. I don't even know how to draw curves on my PowerPoint. I'm sure it can be done, but it's too hard for me, but we don't have to actually do it to get the basic point. If Matthew said lower tax, higher revenue, that's the basic argument. So Laffer said, we can draw a curve that shows the relation between marginal tax rates and the revenue collected. How do we draw such a curve? He said, well, supposing tax rates are zero, then obviously the government isn't going to get any revenue. If the tax rates are nothing, then no revenue. Now, supposing tax rates were 100%, you wouldn't get any revenue either, because nobody would be willing to work. You know, if you have to give everything to the government, you're not going to get any revenue. So we know at 100%, you're going to get zero revenue. 0% is getting zero revenue. So then Laffer said, well, we can draw a curve between these points that shows the relation between the marginal tax rate and the revenue collected. So we have at each point, say, well, how much revenue will the government get if, say, marginal tax rates are 50%? How much will it get at 60%? So you draw a curve, and you have 2 points, and just draw the curve between them. Okay, so this sounds like an interesting point, interesting argument. It's certainly the case, as I said, that tax rate, increasing tax usually has a negative effect on people's incentives to work. So Laffer is perfectly right that increasing tax rate doesn't always add revenue. It might be, say, if you say, well, I'm going to really soak these multimillionaires and take away everything they've got, you're going to find they're not going to work very much, so you're not going to get much. But it doesn't follow from this fact that increasing tax, that decreasing the tax rate will always add revenue. So I should have put this refers to decrease in tax rates. I worry this in a very confusing way. So it may turn out within the range the government cares about that lowering tax rates will reduce government revenue. Now, how could this happen if, let's say, you know, we have it according to the substitution effect, people will be less likely to work if you have higher taxes. So how can it turn out that this Laffer curve doesn't work over this range? How could it be that if you lower the tax rate, people can work harder? But how can it work out that you don't, in a particular case, get more money? Can anybody see why that wouldn't always work out? and bought. Okay, now you have to say then. Well, okay, supposing we decrease taxes. So say, well, people are gonna work harder. So why wouldn't it be that it's always going to be the case that because people work harder, you're going to take in more money. Now, Anderson, if half the curve goes up, well, that's a very good point, Anderson, but why does half the curve go up? Yes, his basic point is, you remember, it's true that you're people are going to be working more at a lower tax rate, but they're also going to be paying less of a share of what they earn to the government. So you don't know you're having the one, the amount of work is going up and the rate of revenue is going down. So if you have the figure out what the effect of both is, you don't know what the effect is going to be relative to a higher tax rate but less work. It would just depend on a particular circumstance. So it need not be the case that decreasing taxes will increase revenue. It just depends on the particular circumstance. Maybe it won't. Now, again, Rothbard makes a very insightful point says, well, why should we care about maximizing government revenue? You know, isn't reducing incentives a good idea? I mean, reducing taxes a good idea, even if government revenue goes down. So that, I think, is a very insightful point, but it's just there's a this particular argument that Lasher was making doesn't always work. Sometimes decreasing tax rates will increase government revenue, will not lead to a fall in government revenue, but sometimes it does. Now there's another and a deeper problem with the Lasher curve is, this is a little more difficult point, so please pay attention to this one. I need to explain this in a, hope I can do it in a clear way. Why should we assume there's a curve at all? What I mean by this? Well, suppose that at a particular tax rate, the government gets a particular amount of revenue, depending on the one. Now, what happens if you slightly change the tax rate? Say, we have it 25% government taking in this amount of revenue. Now we change the tax rate to 30%. That's going to be the effect of revenue. Now, if there is a curve, then the revenue will change slightly. There won't be big jumps. In if we had all sorts of big jumps, we might not have to, we just have kind of a very crooked line going all sorts of ways. We wouldn't have a smooth curve. And we don't have any a priori reason to assume that there is going to be a curve. All that we know is if you have a tax rate, you're going to get a certain amount of revenue. We can't conclude from that if you have a slightly less or more amount of tax rate, you're going to get more, slightly less and more revenue. You don't need to have a curve at all. It could just be some sort of very, you wouldn't be able to, you might not be able to have any kind of, it just looks like sort of a very disjointed assembly of points. You wouldn't be able to draw any kind of smooth curve between. So when people talk about the Lasher curve, you shouldn't assume that there actually is a curve. As you say, this is a little more difficult from that. I think if you think about it, you'll be able to see the difficulty. Now, I want to go in one further argument about taxes. Now, first, we all know, I hope, what we mean by progressive tax. A progressive tax is one that taxes higher income at higher rate. Suppose there's a 10% tax on everybody's income. Then somebody who makes $1 million per year will pay more in taxes than someone who makes $50,000. Of course, makes $1 million a year, he's paying 10%. Let's forget about deductions and also, so he'll be paying 100,000 people. The person who makes $50,000 will only be paying $5,000. But that isn't a progressive tax. That's proportional taxing, because even though the wealthier person is paying absolutely more, he's not paying more in proportion. Now, a progressive tax, say, would require people, say, to pay 25% on incomes over $1 million instead of just 10%. So one thing, when you calculate progressive tax, it doesn't mean you take the highest rate and just apply it to your total income. You would take, say, you'd be getting, say, on your first, whatever the amount is, say, your first $25,000, you pay a certain rate, then on your next, say, $100,000, you pay a higher rate, and you pay even more on a still higher rate. So the progression comes in if you earn more and more money. You have to pay a higher tax rate on that increase. So people who are rather critical of free market, especially on the left, like progressive tax quite a bit. And one argument for progressive taxes goes like this. They say, well, all goods have diminishing marginal utility. Remember, we discussed this in previous lectures, I think, at least I hope so. I don't remember things anymore, so I'm pretty sure we discussed diminishing marginal utility. Remember, it's a very simple idea. As you get more units of a good, you put them to less valued uses. So, say, if I'm supposing I'm buying furniture, so I want a bedroom set, so my first bedroom set, I need someplace to sleep. Now, if I have a chance to buy a second bed, well, if I'm living by myself, I'm not going to have much use for a second bed. Maybe if it has store enough, so I don't have much use for it, so it's going to be much less valuable to me. So as I get more and more units of the good, they diminish in value. So this applies to money too. Say if I don't have any money, then I'm going to not be able to survive very well. So it's very important to me to have some money. I need money to pay my food and rent. But as I get more and more money, then I can buy goods that are less essential to me. I can buy luxury goods. So money is going to be diminishing in marginal utility also. So the argument for progressive taxation based on diminishing marginal utility is that diminishing marginal utility applies to money, then a dollar to a rich person has much less utility than it does to a poor person. Supposing, say, you took away $1,000 from Bill Gates, well, he's not going to really notice it at all. What's $1,000 to him? But if you took $1,000 straight from a poor person like me, I would notice it very much. So the argument is, if you shift the tax burden from the poor and middle class to the rich, this will increase utility, because the rich people don't really value the money as much as the poor people. There was a famous Cambridge economist who was prominent in the 1920s to the 1940s, Arthur Pigou, who defended this argument. He wrote a famous book called Economics of Welfare. And I hope you can see there's a big problem that really knocks this argument out, which is assuming you can measure utility across persons. You could say a dollar to the rich man is worth less than the dollar to the poor man. But in economics, we don't have any interpersonal measure for utility. Remember, utility is just a rank order of people's goods. So it doesn't make sense in economics to say my dollar to me is worth more or less than a dollar to you. We just have rank orders individually of various goods. And this argument really isn't a good one. Now, I want to say a little bit on, I spent most of the lecture on taxation, but I also want to say something about government spending. Now, there are often people favor government spending programs. You've been watching the President Obama having this program of job stimulus and giving the talk to Congress, where he's calling for increased government spending. So why do people favor government spending? Of course, the answer would be they didn't take this course, so they don't know any better. But I bet that isn't the answer we're looking for right now. So basically, there are two reasons people have for favoring government spending. Well, first, they want particular programs, say infrastructure. That's a very popular word now for people. Favor government spending. Like I said, well, we need to have more bridges and roads. We need more, we do highway system, there are all sorts of things that need to be done. So they want these particular goods. They say these programs are especially valuable. They want to have these. And then, aside from the benefits of particular programs, people say that the government spending will stimulate the economy. So not only are these particular goods that we're spending the money on desirable, but the spending itself is desirable. See, this is a separate phenomenon. So that is, just government spending is going to stimulate the economy. And Lord Keynes, the famous British economist, who favored government spending to get people out of depression, just thought, well, spending itself is desirable. And he criticized the British government for just, say, not willing to engage in certain kinds of spending that thought wasteful. He compared this unfavorably with the ancient Egyptians who were building pyramids. So he said, the famous sentence was, two pyramids, two masses for the dead, or twice as good as one, but not so two railways from London to New York. So he's saying, why not spend the money on extra railways because it will stimulate the economy. Now, both of these contingent goals that the government is going to be stimulating the economy, also getting us particular products that we want, like bridges and roads. They're committing the broken window fallacy. Remember, we discussed this in the first lecture. So, so we have to ask, how does the government get the money it spends? Well, if it raises taxes, then people don't have the money, or then should be there. Very bad at proofreading their work. They don't have the money they would have otherwise been able to spend. They would have spent the money on other things. So it's true the government is spending money on particular things, but people have less money to spend on things themselves because of the taxes. So maybe we wouldn't have the bridges and roads if the government didn't have the taxes. We have other things that people wanted to spend the money on, and their spending would be stimulating the economy. Now, but there's a more subtler version of the same fallacy. they, some economists made this argument. Robert Frank, remember I jumped on him a few slides previously. He's used this argument. He said, there are some public works such as bridges and roads that need repair. If they aren't repaired, then they'll require more expensive repairs later. Say the bridge is in very bad shape and deteriorated. If we don't repair it now, we're going to have more expensive repairs later. So if we raise taxes now, we'll be saving money. So he says, well, then we should, when I get to raise taxes, we'll just have to have more expensive repairs later and have even higher taxes in future if we don't raise taxes now. So this is a more sophisticated version of broken window fallacy. And why is that? Well, it's true that spending money on repairs now can be cheaper than waiting until later. I mean, example, say for ordinary life, supposing you could go to the dentist now and you could do, say, cleans your teeth and fixes you up, not much cost, but if you just avoid going to the dentist for years and years, then you're going to have all sorts of bad teeth and you're going to have much more expensive dental repair. So she's sometimes spending money now can save you money in over the long run. But where the broken window fallacy comes in, it's still true that money spent now by the government must be compared with money that people spend on other things, regardless of when the now is. So when, let's say we don't spend the money on the, say we're considering, should we spend the money now on these repairs? We have to compare that with other things people could be spending the money on by themselves. And in future, suppose we have more expensive repairs in future, then we still have to consider that against other things that people could be using the money on then. So it may turn out that people will find it would be better just to abandon these projects that require expensive repairs rather than spend the money on it. So it may turn out that this argument doesn't work because the argument is assuming, well, eventually we'll have to fix them, this infrastructure, so why not do it more cheaply now than later? But it may be that people would prefer just not spending the money on the bridges and roads and just spend it on something else. So it would be more expensive to repair if they wanted to repair it at all. But that's just what the issue is. Do they want to repair it at all? And shouldn't that be for the individuals rather than the government to decide? Now, in objection to what I've said so far, remember I like this way of proceeding where you get objections and then you come to them. Now, suppose the government doesn't increase taxes, just increases spending, but doesn't increase taxes. Well, what happens then? It's going to go into debt. So if it does that, isn't it true the government spending is stimulating the economy, but without taking away from other things that people would have spent their money on? So I said, well, there's a broken window fallacy. That the usual argument for government spending is committing it, or people say for government spending, you're saying we're forgetting that the tax money is reducing consumer spending on taxpayer spending on other things, so there isn't going to be a net stimulus. But what if the government just increases the money without increasing taxes? Well, the problem there is that going into debt leads to inflation, and also the debt will have to be repaid eventually. If the government doesn't repay the debt, then they're going to get all sorts of problems that we see happening. countries that are in default with raises a lot of problems with. So if the debt has to be repaid eventually, then taxes will increase. So this, if the government doesn't increase its taxes now, it's just delaying taxes increases rather than getting rid of them altogether. Rebecca asked a question about printing money. So this is the answer. They're just going into debt. If they just print money, that's going to be inflationary. Now, there's a very controversial claim. Remember I said so far, well, they're going to have to, if they go into debt, then they're going to have to increase tax eventually. So one controversial claim is if the government increases spending without increasing taxes, then the attempt to stimulate the economy won't be successful. So this argument says, look, remember the previous argument says, well, the government spends but takes money in taxes, and it's just taking away from what people otherwise would be spending, submitting the broken window fountain. So this new argument says, well, even increases spending without increasing taxes, the attempt to stimulate the economy won't be successful. Now, how does this argument go? Well, the argument is, and this was called Ricardian equivalence because the great early 19th century economist David Ricardo advanced this argument at least one time in his career. He said, people will anticipate taxes will go up. You say the government is spending, but it is increasing taxes. People say, well, taxes are eventually going to go up, so they'll reduce their spending, and they'll increase savings to prepare for the higher taxes. So then this argument is the government program to stimulate the economy by increasing spending won't work because people will just reduce their private spending. Now, say this is the Ricardian equivalence argument. Now, the extent to which this actually happens is disputed. Some economists, like Robert Farrell, who's a very influential country, just put his name down here. He's a very influential, he thinks this is a very important phenomenon. The professor of Harvard favors this argument, so he says it's very important. He's very critical of government spending programs because of the Ricardian equivalent. Other economists, they know people don't actually plan ahead in that way, so they don't always act that way. So the extent to which this happens is just something we have to find out in particular cases, how much it happens. And this is part of Austrian economics, that people always act in the way this Ricardian equivalence assumes. Now, the last thing I want to mention is the point, the recycled point that Henry Hazlitt made, I thought, in the reading. So he said that government spending is going to displace private spending. Now, can we go further? Can we say anything more than that? We say, well, government spending's gone up, private spending, if you have taxes, government spending's gone up, private spending's gone down. So what Hazlitt points out is if money's in private hands, then investment's likely to go to people with a proven track record of success. And say you're not, if you have money to invest, you're going to give it to people who are good at building successful businesses. You're not just going to throw away the money on very risky measures because people are very careful about investing their own money. But this isn't true for government spending because government officials aren't spending their own money. They're just, they don't have to pay themselves the project or work that they invest in. So they're going to be it's very likely that if government has, if you have government spending, they think the government spends the money on it, won't do as well as if the money were left in private hands. Well, I guess that will conclude our government spending and taxation lecture. So I see you can see why, if I've been at all successful in the lecture, why I don't agree with Oliver Wendell Holmes that taxation is the price we pay for civilization. In fact, taxation is rather anti-civilization. So, okay, so now I'm going to press this Q&A thing, and if you have questions, please put them in there. Let me see if I do this right. Okay, so go ahead and type in the question you want in the Q&A. Jay says, Paul Krugman points out that debt is high and inflation is low. How do the Austrians answer him? Well, and Chris says, how is going to debt lead to inflation? Yes, this is really a good answer. According to the Austrians, you get inflation through an increase in the supply of money. And very often, when the government goes into debt, there is an increase in the supply of money, but not always. Now, if there is an increase in the supply of money and inflation is low, the assumption would be, well, there are various factors acting to counter the normal effect of the increase of money, what those would be in particular circumstances, it just depends on particular circumstances, but that's not something we can figure out a priori. Remember, in Austrian economics, we're not dealing with quantitative relations, so we're not saying, well, if you have the money supply increasing by such and such an amount, then prices will increase by such and such amount. We're not going to give quantitative relationship. This is the criticism he has made in free money and credit of the quantity theory of money at the Great American College of Irving Fisher. Rebecca, do you believe it would be possible to eliminate the federal income tax and operating consumption tax only? Well, that, I hope it's not a cop-out, that would just depend on what activities the government is doing. I think they should get rid of both the federal income tax and consumption tax. I think we should leave everything for the private market. But whether the government could operate on a particular tax, would just depend on what activities companies engage in, what they cost. So, you would want it, before you could answer that question, you have to specify a certain level of activity for the government. Chris says, I missed the answer question, why lowering taxes doesn't necessarily raise revenues for the government. Well, you see, Chris, what you've got two effects that are operating counter to each other. If you have a higher rate of taxes, if you have 90% instead of 10%, you're getting more out of each chunk of income that people reporting on their taxes. So if you have a higher rate, just from that, you're getting more revenue than the lower rate. However, at the lower rate, people are more likely to work than at the higher rate. So that's operating the other way, saying, well, okay, at 90%, you're going to get more money per, say, particular $1 million. Than 20% for a $1 million income, or you're going to have fewer $1 million incomes reported at 90% than 20%. So the issue is a very simple one. You don't know in a particular case which effect is going to be more. that and just have to see what happens will have the, you see the point. Just you can deduce just from the fact that people work more at a lower rate, that's going to raise more revenue because you're also taking in less money because of the lower rate. Now, Rebecca says mainly military courts, police. Well, I don't know. I don't see why they couldn't operate just on consumption tax. But that would just depend on the particular empirical circumstances. And Rebecca also asked, couldn't roads be funded by visa registration fee tolls? So on. Yes, I mean, I don't see why not, but you know, I don't know the particulars about how certain programs are funded and how much they cost. That would just require investigation of particular circumstances. Okay, we still have another 20 minutes or so. It's getting very warm weather here in Los Angeles. About 200 degrees, even hotter in the shade, and melting already. And now Chrissy says, okay, a little off topic, but what do you think of the 999 plan, Thurman King? Well, I haven't gone into details about that. I think my general view, which is followers of Morocco, is less tax, the better. So I like the part about reducing income tax for people who pay more than 9%, but not the increase in sales tax. And it should be, remember, some people now who pay less than 9%, one problem with a flat tax is it increases the tax burden on some people. I don't think that's a very good thing in that. So remember, again, get back to Jay's point, very important to bear in mind the Austrian, because the point of what are your, separate your ethical judgments from the effects of economic analysis. I see there's a question, Christy said, what kind of tax rates to Austrians if there are no tax? Well, the ones that should follow the Rothbard would say no tax at all. Now, Patricio asked, do you see any hope to Austrian economic more rational taxation in the emerging markets? Well, I'm not sure which countries you're referring to. I mean, I hope that people are influenced by Austrian economics, but I really don't know enough about particular economies to be able to judge how much they're actually influential. We do find that in Mises, people who study Mises are prominent in some countries. I know the Justice Minister of Lithuania is a Misesian. And Patricia says, in general terms, Singapore, other nations in Asia. Well, I think they tend to have a more free market policy than other places. I hope that continues, but again, I'm not really couldn't say very much on what they're going to do here. That requires familiarity with those particular economies. I'm just trying to get some of the basic principles of economic reasoning. And you have to be able to apply those principles to particular data about countries to be able to make judgments about those countries' policies. And I must tell you, I hope it's not too much of a difference. disappointment that my own theory is in more political philosophy and certain branches of history. I'm not very current on how actual economies are working. If you want to know all the latest on Wall Street, I'm not the one to ask. Of course, I didn't tell you that in your lecture, you have to wait till it's too late to drop the course here, because I'd be losing money, but I'm not the one to ask about particular development and how particular economies are doing. I see another question from Christie, tax reducing private income and leisure, any tax on beneficial. Well, I'd be inclined to say no, because a tax is changing, is trying to alter what people who have money prefer to do with that. So it doesn't follow that there aren't any things that the government can do with the money that give people benefits, but they're just not willing to do what they prefer to do on their own. Say if you're looking at if you oppose taxation, you're not committed, say, to saying that the Versailles Palace in France is a bad looking building. It's a very beautiful palace, but it's just not what people would expect money on themselves from materials. Okay, we still have another 12 minutes. Oh, here's one from Justin. What do you think of Warren Buffett asking to be taxed more? Well, you see, I think he's free to, if he feels like paying more, the government is free to give them more. I don't think he should try to do it. I mean, what if other people don't want to be taxed? You know, why should they do that? Reminds me of the old joke where a man comes into a bar and he said, drinks for everybody in the bar. When I drink, everybody drinks. And after a few minutes, he said, another round of drinks for everybody in the bar. When I drink, everybody drinks. Then he takes out a dollar and slams it on the bar. He said, when I pay, everybody pays. But you see, similar thing, you know, Warren Buffett said, well, I want to be taxed. Well, that's what he wants, but why should he want to determine what's done to everybody else? Or drug somebody, he was with Matthew, laughed at my joke, good for you, Matthew. That's worth at least 10 points in the next quiz. And Matthew says, I think my question pertains more to last week. In the whole Buy American tax, we hear kind of a guilt tariff. That's a very insightful point. I mean, I think when people say Buy American, they're assuming that if you don't buy American, but you buy foreign goods instead of American goods, you're going to be hurting the American economy. So if you, well, if we spend money on American goods, we're helping America. So we're American, we should be spending money on American goods instead of helping out the foreigners. But, you know, if we apply some basic economic principles, we're not hurting ourselves by spending money on foreign goods. We're just increasing the international division of labor. We're increasing the prosperity of the American people. We're not hurting ourselves by spend the money that you want. Now, Erica said another question relating to last week's discussion of international trade. Suppose one country, Japan, for instance, choose to return to gold standard while the rest of the world is still using fiat money. Now that's a very interesting question. I mean, what would happen there? It wouldn't particularly have any effect on it because of the way you remember how I answered your question from last week. It wouldn't have any particular effect on either increase or decrease in employment in either the fiat money country or the gold standard country. It would have all sorts of very complicated effects on the financial system, but that's not something I'm going to be discussing in the course talk because I don't know enough about it to be able to deal with. That's a very advanced topic. But you see, it's not going to affect the employment. Now, Erica says American importers would have to buy gold in order to buy Japanese cars. What would happen to both economies over time, especially if the U.S. is continuing to inflate? Then that would probably act as a break to the deterrent to too much inflation, because then they'd find it more difficult to buy gold. So the price of gold would be going up in dollars, so that would act as a break on the inflation. That's, again, a very good question, Eric. You asked a very good question. Sorry, I didn't give you a good answer last week, but that's a question. Jay says, tax reduced efficiency in the economy are used to increase equity. How do Austrians approach the subject of equity through distribution? Well, Jay, this is, an excellent question. It's very much related to the question you asked last week about the relationship between ethics and economics. You see, we can get from economics a sort of certain notion of efficiency. We can just define that. But when we talk about equity, this involves an ethical judgment. Now, Austrians, particularly in the law court, tend to reject the notion of equity or an equity efficiency trade-off. Equity, as used by economists or intellectuals, tends to mean a more egalitarian distribution. So suppose we have something like people always complaining, their CEOs are earning 5,000 times more than the people who are in the lower levels of the company. So it's a very bad thing. So this is assuming that some sort of more equal distribution is desirable. So what the Austrians, the colleagues at Rothbard would say is, well, what exactly is the argument for that? We shouldn't just assume, well, equality is a good thing, too much inequality of income, wealth, and bad. I don't know what is the basis for that judgment. Again, this is not strictly part of economics, but if you take on the Rothbardian line, you wouldn't have an equity efficiency trade-off, but the view would be people are entitled to whatever money they earn on the free market, and if it works out that particular people have very much better off than others, that is a point against that distribution. Jay, are you from your questions, I think are you've taken courses in kind of more mainstream economics, so I guess you're finding this Austrian approach very different. Is that right? Okay, Lester, he says, supposedly go back to the days before taxes were automatically withheld from it. Do you think people's attitudes for paying taxes have changed? Well, you know, when withholding taxes were introduced, you know, in World War II, Milton Friedman played a role in introducing it under Beardsley Rumor, I think it's one of the officials. So the reason they did that was they thought, well, people would be very reluctant to pay taxes if things got to April 15th, you're going to have to shell out all the money. People wouldn't want to do that. Of course, people could save up the money they were supposed to pay in taxes, but a lot of people wouldn't do that, so probably people would be more reluctant to pay taxes, and that's one of the reasons paying taxes change. Max says, I always like the way Milton Friedman explained the four ways to spend money. Are you familiar in New Austrian believe the same? Well, I don't often. What are the four ways to spend money? See, I couldn't answer what I believe the same until I know what the four ways are. Okay, we still have another couple minutes, and anybody have something? Justin says, do you know what the original arguments for the income tax in the U.S. were? Well, I think they just thought that would be the government needed to raise more money, and that would be a way to do it. And they've done that in the Civil War, and the income tax had gone out of use, and then there were proposals to revive it in the 1890s. So the government played a more active role, so they favored the income tax. Of course, when the tax was first put in, it just operated only very few people in the economy had to pay it. But I think the argument basically said that they wanted the government to have an additional service of revenue. Okay, well, we have group time for another. Anybody have a last question or two? Or Christopher says, in the introduction to economic reason page, somebody's actually read my book, you asked that why is equality taken to be an uncontested thing? You want to know what's the answer. Well, there the question is kind of rhetorical with one. I'm suggesting maybe it shouldn't be. I suppose the reason people do take it to be uncontested is they, you know, sometimes people just have judgment, immediate judgment that things are good or bad. If you say, well, why would it be, suppose you see someone who just run over by a car and just lying in the street, or they thought, well, it would be a good idea to call an ambulance instead of just walking by. So it's kind of an immediate judgment you make about a particular case. So some people, especially those who are on the left, tend to have that sort of judgment about equality. So, well, there's something bad if particular people earn much more than others. And I don't agree with that, if people in terms undermined. I mean, there isn't anything intrinsically bad about some people having a lot more than others. There might well be something bad about people not being able to have enough money to provide for themselves. So that's a different judgment than saying it's bad that some people have much more money than others. Well, okay, so I guess we're out of time now. Unless somebody has some last question or two. But so thanks very much for, oh, I hear Matthew give me the four ways. You owe your own money on yourself, your own money on a third person, a third person's money on yourself, a third person's money on a third person. The last example brings government lease incentives to spend wisely. Ah, I see what that, yes. Well, that was very much related to my last slide where it has it was suggested if the government is spending the money, it's not spending, they're not, the bureaucrats, government officials are not spending their own money, so they're less likely to be, they don't have much incentive. So I think Freedom from, thank you for putting that in. Freedom was quite right. There's really the same point that I was making, just which I got from Henry Hansel in this last slide. So Matthew, thanks very much for pointing that out. Okay, so hope we'll see you all next week. And I want to recommend, call to your attention, Danny Sanchez and I are giving a course on libertarian ethics. Very good course because Danny's one of the top experts on Mises ethics, and he'll be giving three lectures on that. So I urge everybody to enroll for that. We need a lot more students in this course so I can make more money. So please try to enroll in that. Be charitable to me. Okay, well, thanks everybody. So I hope we'll see you all next week. Bye everybody.